The Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes of this program are available free of charge, more than 500 episodes and counting. Your support makes a difference. If you like the program and you want to support it, you can go to patreon.com/otherpplpod. That's patreon.com/otherpplpod. Thank you.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer can do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jake, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person.
Yeah, hello. Hi, everybody. This is the Other People podcast. Welcome to the Other People show. I'm Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles, and I have good news for you. Maggie Nelson is back on the program after a five-year break. She needed a five-year break after the first time, but she was kind enough to come back over, sit down with me, talk to me, and she's got a new poetry collection, kind of a new old poetry collection. It's a reissue called Something Bright Then Holes. It was originally published in 2007 and is now out in a brand new edition from Soft Skull Press. For those of you who are unaware, or any of you unaware, Maggie Nelson is the author of 9 books of poetry and prose. She won the National Book Critics Circle Award for The Argonauts. She won a MacArthur Genius Fellowship, a Guggenheim. She wrote The Art of Cruelty. She wrote Bluettes, The Red Parts, Jane, A Murder. The list goes on. So very pleased to get a chance to talk to Maggie, pick her brain a little bit, and share that conversation with you. Before we get there, she's going to read a poem from her collection. Again, the title is called Something Bright Then Holes. And this is Maggie Nelson reading from that collection. I'll let her introduce it.
This poem is called What Is It? From a longer series of poems called The Canal Diaries. What is it? A sad dusk here, the water swollen with debris, the blue wrapper of an almond joy, the hourglass of a maxi. Some of the garbage sinks inexplicably, but most of it just floats by, a bag of Lay's, another maxi. Today the man in black wears glasses. I wonder how much one has to drink to achieve that nose. Yet I get the feeling he doesn't drink anymore. He greets a filthy dog brought by a skinny hippie. The dog's teeth are bloodstained, his hair falling out in clumps. He doesn't really know what he wants, the hippie says, as his dog sniffs the water. Join the club, says the man in black. The hippie tells us his dog has terrible luck. A week ago, it fell into a silo. Yesterday, it got electrocuted while peeing on a pole. We don't really know how to respond. The sky is amazing tonight, full of blurry swans. Why should I keep writing you, I ask? Because there's a purity in it. And so there is. When the hippie finally leaves, the man in black whispers to me, it walks like a parrot, is scrawny, fishes, and has dark legs. What is it? How the hell should I know? I'm living a lie.
Okay, that is Maggie Nelson reading from her wonderful poetry collection, Something Bright Then Holes, available now in a beautiful reissue from Soft Skull Press. Let's get to the conversation. Right? This is Maggie Nelson.
You can read other people's Twitter feeds if you do not do Twitter.
Do you do that?
Yeah, I read, well, politics, I read stuff all the time.
Okay, but, yeah, so well, that makes sense.
But you don't have to, you can look at people's Instagram, too. I mean, I just don't, like, have accounts or participate, yeah.
But how often do you read, like, other people's Twitter?
Well, I read, you know.
Like, daily?
The Deep State, I read every day.
Yeah. I mean, how can you not? And I feel right. Like, too, I was, you know, I have this thought pretty much every day, but it's like, how could you possibly be living through this particular moment in American history?
Yeah.
And not have some consciousness of Twitter.
Yeah.
Because so much of the action is on Twitter.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And there's this like really weird and often stressful lag between like the news that you're getting on Twitter versus where the mainstream media is.
Exactly, yeah.
And Twitter's like way out in front.
Exactly, yeah.
And so you know that.
I do know that.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know it as well as some people probably know it insofar as it's not fed to me. But I feel like if I want to know like what's happening at the Manafort trial or something, I know who's in there or whatever. You may know who it's like. I know who to go to, but I have to choose to go look and see what they say.
Okay.
I don't have like a feed, I guess was what you call it.
And is there any chance at all we could see Maggie Nelson on Twitter at some point? Would you ever break down now that you have this phone? Would you ever just be like, fuck it, I'm going in?
No, I don't know what you, I have zero.
You have so much to say, but you save it for your books.
I have nothing I can imagine saying. Like, nothing. It's never, I can't even imagine anything. I just can't imagine a single sentence.
I bet you would be good at it. I'm not trying to talk you into it. I'm just saying,
I think it's interesting, actually, because, I mean, I've written about this a little bit, but I do think that if you're somebody who writes autobiographically, or who's, some people think, you know, a lot of questions I get in interviews are like, how do you feel about exposing all of your personal life, which I don't feel like I do. So, but I feel like, I've always been really interested in autobiography. And, you know, I wrote, when I was a teenager, my undergraduate thesis was on confession and literature. I mean, I've always been really interested in it, but I think it's very fascinating to know how kind of old school, and in some ways, I feel about, you know, this sounds really cheesy, and I know that Twitter's an art, blah, 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 but about, like, making kind of aesthetic objects or products versus kind of the slow dribble, you know? The slow dribble doesn't, and it's not very interested in it. You know?
I think that's wiser. Yeah. It's a deeper dive to work on a book, and I think that when you're feeding people Twitter, I mean, some people are really good at quipping.
Yeah.
And that can
be
enjoyable, but it's still kind of fast food. Like the fast food, slow food thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just kind of most of my critical writing, and maybe even otherwise too, but I think I'm kind of plagued by the whole, you know, seeing this side and seeing that side and seeing this side. And I'm very, the thing I hate most about writing is it's kind of, I don't hate it the most, but like, you know, Roland Barthes said, like, writing, you know, language asserts, you know, so like everything you say asserts. And so I always feel like I try and get into my writing a kind of like a kind of merry-go-round of assertion, and like trying to, you know, kind of keep undercutting, you know, like Wittgenstein's whole, like, tearing the rungs off the ladder as you're climbing it. But that takes time, because you have to think around a thought to be able to perform that kind of, merry-go-round and Twitter, or those kind of things. Like, you know, I just think of it as very, like, you know, linear slices where you don't, you know, which is why obviously it leads to so much proclamation and virtue signaling, because it can't contain that. I mean, it can over time if you look at someone's feed, but it doesn't.
And who wants to do that? Like, sit there and go through?
No, but it's not its purpose. It's not its, like, its communicative purpose is not to do that kind of work. So it doesn't really seem very interesting to me.
I always say, once this presidency's over with, I'm going to get off.
I totally agree with you, and I don't know. And we'll have to check back in.
Yeah.
God knows. Maybe hopefully we'll check back in this afternoon, but maybe we'll check back in, and God knows when. I know.
Well, I want to start talking to you about this idea of care.
Uh-huh.
Like, I like this as a theme.
Uh-huh.
I like this as an idea life, and it's something that I don't think I've had an explicit conversation about, and it appears in your poetry collection, which, by the way, and I know you probably get asked this a lot, it's a reissue.
That's correct. Yeah.
And so you're having this work that you did a decade ago be rolled back out into the world. And I'm sure you've had to revisit the book and revisit the person that you were a decade or more ago when it was written. Like, what's that like? Are you comfortable with it?
Oh yeah, it's fun. I mean, it's mostly fun for me because of the genre, because it's the last poetry book I did, so it feels like kind of a whole other, it feels like a freer self or something, like the poetry itself that I haven't been for, and I'm like cogitate so much for everything, you know?
Yeah.
But no, I mean, it's been lovely, and I think that, you know, I don't feel strong disavowals of earlier selves, really, or anything like that. So
not neurotic.
No, I mean, no. I mean,
because
even as I say that about Twitter, and I'm kind of making fun of that whole dribbling thing, I mean, I definitely came up in a poetry world that was that, you know, what people call like the Frank O'Hara, I do this, I do that school of New York talk poetry, really. And which was, I mean, it's funny that you talk about caring, because I wrote about this a lot in a book I wrote about the New York School. There was a lot of dialectic or whatever between like not caring and caring, you know, caring kind of greatly about some things and really not caring about others vis-a-vis literature, but also other things. So I think that the kind of not caring about your past selves is, you know, kind of a certain kind of non-preciousness about who you've been. It seems wise to me. Yeah. Or what you've written, you know.
Yeah, just let it go. It's a snapshot. Yeah. But I think there's also in the book and along these same lines, like this idea of caring for others.
Yeah.
Caring for the world, like compassion, you know, like these kinds of ideas. And it moved me just because it had this like simplifying or crystallizing effect where you can get, or I can at least get lost in the weeds when it comes to morality and what should I be doing with my life?
Yeah.
And am I doing this right? Should I do this? Should I do that? Yeah. But then it's like, you know, what about just caring about the people in your immediate sphere, trying to be good to them, trying to take good care of them?
Yeah.
We were talking before I came on, like I have a son with health challenges.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of care in that.
Yeah.
And like that's a noble thing to be doing with time. So I don't know. I appreciated like the hospital section in particular where you're with your friend who had the accident.
Yeah.
Maybe you could summarize like that section of the book for listeners who haven't read.
You know, this poetry book, Something Bright Than Holes, has three sections, and the first is called The Canal Diaries, and the last is called Something Bright Than Holes, but the middle is called the, I don't know what it's called, I think it's just called The Hospital for Special Care.
Over the Hospital.
That was a long poem in there called The Halo Over the Hospital,
yeah.
And I mean, my friend Christina Crosby, who you should also have on, should she be able to come out here in her wheelchair and whatnot, but I've, you know, she's been a longtime muse of mine. She appears in many, many of my books. And she just wrote a book called A Body Undone, A Living On After Great Pain, about her accident, which is a really terrific book and really an amazing book. And anyway, so she appears in Bluettes and she appears in, this is the first book, I think, where I wrote these poems about her right after her accident. And then I write about her in The Argonauts, but I don't. Right,
she had a bicycle accident.
That's correct, yeah.
So she was riding her bike 1 minute, healthy.
Yeah.
And then flipped the bike, paralyzed.
Exactly, yeah. I think the week of her 50th birthday. So the poems in there, I was living nearby and started doing regular shifts at the hospital, and she was in obviously intensive care and then at a place called the Hospital for Special Care for some time. And I mean, I think what's interesting about care and those poems and other things I've written too is that, I mean, I like what you're saying about this kind of simplicity of like providing care to the people in your lives is, but I think, you know, I've also been, I think all the books also hopefully attend to the difficulties of care, not just the difficulties of performing it, but also the way some people are more obligated in this society to provide care than others, the way that we determine. I mean, I've been writing recently about freedom and how we often, it's kind of a tradition of determining freedom as not having to care about other people's feelings or bodies or whatever. And so I think, and freedom is, you know, not, I'm not saying that kind of freedom is the best kind of freedom, but I don't think it can be entirely dismissed of like what, you know, so I think that the poems in there, as much as I felt like I was doing something that felt like I needed to do both for her and for me by being there for her and by helping in her the care of her first year or two when she got home from the hospital. You know, when someone, I mean, she writes about this in her book, but when someone's, and I don't know what your son's situation is exactly, but when someone's rendered into what she calls, you know, total care, which is what she needed for quite some time when you really can't do anything for yourself. You know, the need often more outstrips what can be provided by any, you know, by any single person or few people even. And I think that that can obviously creates a lot of turmoil, you know, for everybody involved and is essentially also a condition of the planet and that people need, and the planet itself, more care than we're providing it, or that, you know, in some sense feels possible. So I think it's a very challenging, it's both kind of like Ian Forrester, like connect. It's like, yes, care, only care, but what that means and what it means also for different people for whom their obligation to work in caring professions or to, you know, to do different things is so much more mandated, I guess.
The stress levels for people who work in caregiving, whether it's like mental health professionals or people who work in an ER or in a children's hospital.
Yeah.
I cannot imagine like what kind of like rewiring or what kind of hardwiring you have to have in order to go in day in and day out and bear witness to all that.
I mean, not to mention that, as we know, I mean, the caring professions are notoriously underpaid and undervalued. So you also have people who are, I mean, and Christina writes about this in her book. She has a whole chapter called Caring at the Cash Nexus about how many people who've cared for her have been people of color who work, you know, double shifts and a third job maybe even besides and stuff, and how just how needing total care also brings you into a world of, if you weren't there already, of seeing the, you know, the profound injustice of how we reward or don't reward the activity of caring, you
it's
know.
Like teaching so, too.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, although, you know, teaching is, yeah, to what extent teaching is caring is complicated. I mean, that's the other thing is that, I mean, I've noticed a lot of Buddhist books sprinkled around your house. And I mean, I'm also very interested in, like, I mean, I wrote about this in The Art of Cruelty because the care thing, I think, kind of started coming out in that book where I got very interested in this kind of notion of, like, you know, different virtues having kind of near and far enemies, and that, like, you know, there's compassion, but there's also idiot compassion, and, like, how do we tell the difference? And there's certainly kinds of forms of, you know, ways that we can talk ourselves into caring that are probably protectionism or, you know, being patronizing or, you know, all kinds of things. And so it's also very difficult to know what's the care.
It sucks when you fail at caring.
Exactly.
I'm just trying to care. I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. I mean, well, how often do we think that, you know? Yeah. I mean, how often do we say to our children, like, you know, I don't let him watch TV and he yells at me, I'm the worst mother ever. And I say, I'm actually caring for you. And he's like, no, you're not. I actually explained idiot compassion the other day. And I said, giving you all the candy and television you want wouldn't be caring. And he was like, oh, I got to tell you, it really would be, you know? So it's very, I mean, that's kind of also, you know, that's like the parent's burden too, right? Is that, like, you're trying to provide what you think is the right kind of care, knowing that every kind of care also has its kind of shadow again of kind of not failure, you know, not doing it right.
And, like, I think about this sometimes, especially, like, not to belabor the conversation with too much politics, but it's so frustrating to think about people who are on the Trump train for me. But I think if, like, to go to, like, Buddhism or something and, like, the books that I'm always reading, trying to get my head straight, like, I think they're telling me that I should love those people.
This is an ongoing question of the Trump era, you know.
Like, how do you care for people who you feel are espousing really hurtful ideology and belief and who are acting in ways that are reprehensible? And it's like, how do you have space in your heart for somebody like that? How do you care for those people? And, like,
well, again, I mean, I don't think they need our idiot compassion, you know, which would be to offer forms of care that were enabling or, you know, accepting of their behavior, you know. So I think it's difficult to, you know, I mean, it's, I mean, it could be a form of care to not have somebody eat in your restaurant. You know what I mean? Like, it's staying focused on, like, just the most superficial level of, like, would I offer them my hand or, you know, or even, like, do they have a place in my heart? It's like, what does that even really mean? I mean, I think that, but I do think that, you know, I mean, I think, let's just say that good people differ on the opinion of, like, I mean, I've read very, you know, well-meaning, good intention, perhaps spiritually wise op-eds about how, like, we shouldn't teach our children that Donald Trump is a bad person. You know, I don't see why not, honestly.
If he's not,
I don't know who is. Right. And so, and I also feel like when one doesn't have to ultra demonize, but one has to also, you know, I feel like, again, like I don't want to perform an idiot compassion and, you know, to my kids and, you know, I want them to know what behavior we consider to be, you know, ethical and what kind we don't, you know?
Right.
So,
yeah, it's hard. It's I mean, I try not to talk about it too much.
Yeah.
I just feel like less is more. If she asks about it, I answer.
Right.
My daughter knows where I stand. I mean, she's heard me grumbling, but, like, I'm not sitting down being like, have you read the deep state Twitter today?
I know. I mean, but, you know, it's very, like, I mean, it's very, I mean, in some ways, even though they don't know very much, kids' questions have a way of really laying bare. I mean, you know, my son was asking me the other day, you know, why I was sure we weren't going to be separated, you know, the way that he'd heard Trump was separating families. And, you know, as I kept giving him different reassurances, which all felt to me terrible because they rely on this, you know, mirage of citizenship, you know, and he was saying, well, how do you know he won't come and take our passports? And I was like, you know, at a certain point, I was like, you got me, man. I was like, I don't know what's coming, you know, like, I really don't. But, like, you know, his you know, I feel like I have to address the fact that, you know, they feel they you know, that they're wise. They know to be nervous, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And they talk to each other.
They do.
You know,
yeah.
There's like playground chat.
Yeah. No, it's true.
But you mentioned Buddhism, and it brought to mind, something I had meant to ask you about. And that is that I was reading one of these, books by Mark Epstein, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And you blurbed it.
That's true.
And I was like, wow, Maggie Nelson's blurbing a Buddhism book. Like, yeah, yeah. What's the connection?
You know, Mark, I think, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I'd known about Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart when I had been, you know, as per the title, and as if you've read The Argonauts, to any people listening, I mean, it's like kind of a main theme of that book. And actually, it's one of the main themes of a book of mine called The Red Parts as well, which has a kind of meditation on brokenness and pieces and what it means to have things fall apart while hanging together or something. So, I mean, I'd known about that, but then he actually, I think, contacted me fairly out of the blue because he'd read The Argonauts and I think had, you know, not knowing that he was one of the original sources, probably had, you know, was interested in what I'd had to say about Winnicott. And so we started corresponding from there, and then I was happy to provide that for him. Yeah,
it just caught me by surprise. But yeah. Are you like a Buddhist interest at all?
I mean, I'm interested, but I'm not. I'm a, you know,
atheist.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not a, I haven't like taken vows or anything. I don't, right. you know, so I'm, you know, so I was going to say layperson, but I think layperson is even too exalted for my, but you know, I mean, I think it's, I think that kind of like you said, when you said you were trying to get your head on straight, I feel like, you know, many conundrums, intellectual or otherwise, that I have difficult time with, are often very solved to me by consulting the Buddhist books on my shelves and not some of the others. So I consider it both, you know, spiritual, for lack of a better word, but also really intellectual,
logical
assistance, you know?
Yeah. I'm the same way. I mean, I was like, I never know what to call myself. I guess if I had to call myself something, I'd call myself Buddhist, but
yeah,
I've been to one retreat.
Right. Yeah.
I don't go to a temple.
Yeah.
I don't have a guru. Yeah. I wish I had a guru.
Right.
It'd be so nice. Like a real good, like a real true master.
Yeah.
Just teach me how to do this.
I know. It's funny. I won't talk about it too much because I haven't, but I was actually spending yesterday writing about the Me Too movement comes to Shambhala Buddhism phenomenon. So all that's been really fascinating to me
Tell me, what do I know about this?
Oh, no, just Google the New York Times, the Sakyong, who's the current Shambhala Buddhism, you know,
person,
yeah,
patriarch,
having a, yeah, he just resigned.
Oh,
and there's the kind of a whole.
Yeah, thing, I was just, you know, if we're gonna be sharing, yeah. I was just writing about like the first like yoga teacher that I ever went to,
uh-huh.
Random. Like I was like doing yoga a lot when I was in my early 20s, and you sort of get hooked.
Yeah,
it's like pot
totally.
Without paranoia.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And he wound up years later, like moving out of state, setting up a studio in another state. Mm-hmm. And then I Googled him like out of the blue.
Yeah,
I was like,
I wonder
what he's up to.
Yeah, yeah.
Arrested for sexually assaulting students during class.
Wow.
Convicted and jailed.
Really? Wow. That must have been quite a class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, like
class. That's not a normal adjustment.
No.
But
I mean, it was just like,
the
truth is that I wasn't like totally surprised.
Yeah.
But it's always a little bit.
That's
like,
funny. I was just reading the other day about how some yoga classes were providing like little cards that you could put on your mat that said no adjustments, please, whatever, if you didn't want to be touched. Yeah,
I like an adjustment, but no one ever wants to touch me because I'm all sweaty and disgusting.
No, I mean, the reason why, you know, I don't want to go into it too much because I haven't quite sorted out, you know, I don't know enough about all of it. But, you know, I think it's all quite fascinating insofar as if you have especially I'm not denying that there aren't obviously power dynamics with Buddhist teachers, but if you have a ideology that's so much based on kind of thinking and finding out things for yourself, the question of kind of, you know, how much one needs to be warned or protected against, you know, teachers that might hit on you or something I think it's interesting, you know, I think it's interesting. And I don't think as a feminist, it's clear at all where one should stand on such matters, you know?
Yeah. No. And then there's like the whole like Bikram thing, which is like ultra creepy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
This stuff, anywhere that there's a hierarchy, especially when people are, you know, you're dealing in feelings and emotions and people's toughest stuff.
Yeah.
you know, there's going to be opportunities for predators.
Yeah. And, I mean, you know, I was, you know, I went to high school in the Haight-Ashbury, and, you know, I feel like my formative years were spent, you know, I learned very young that, you know, the hippies were not my friend. Yeah. The guy hippies lining the street saying, you know, why don't you smile, sunshine, that they were not, they were not the key to my,
I had a friend,
my liberation.
I had a friend I went to high school with who like went full hippie, and right. I was Midwest.
Yeah.
So like the hippie thing didn't even get to right. where we lived until I was in high school.
Yeah.
There's like a very slow migration of culture, you know, in the country. And so I remember though, he was like, he seemed authentic to me. He was like, wow, his hair's long and he has the clothes and he like, and I remember we were out like getting like a sandwich or something and the waitress came over and he was like, thanks, sister. I was like, what are you doing?
Forget.
I was like, what are you doing?
I know, right?
But you know, I never went that far to my everlasting credit.
I was much happier to arrive in New York and get away from, you know, everyone in New York when I, not maybe after a while as I got more uptight, but when I first got there, everyone was like, you're really loose. And I was like, this is great. Like I really arrived. You know?
And then over time you just like start to.
Yeah, I probably, yeah. But now I don't know what I am. LA is a weird place because everyone's really uptight and really loose at the same time. So
yeah, what is
it
LA?
It can be both. I don't know.
I can't, been here almost 20 years.
Are,
I can't
really,
make sense of it. I don't, you know, I still feel confused by it. I feel like it's an unknowable place, which I kind of like.
Yeah.
I don't want to ever, I think I would get bored if I was like, oh, I got this place dialed.
Yeah.
Like Los Angeles just feels like, what's the word? Oceanic.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like vast, like sea of everything. And you can just get lost in it.
Yeah. No, it's really not a place I imagine living for long as I live here.
And now here we are.
I know. Here we are. I know. And I last saw you 5 years ago and here we still are. So,
I know.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I want to ask you, like, speaking of gurus, and like this desire to have like somebody who really knows teach me the way. Like you have benefited in your, it seems like based on your writing, from having like a lot of really great mentors.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely.
You write about them.
I do.
And it's like Annie Dillard.
Yeah.
And then forgive me, your friend who had the accident.
Oh, Christina Crosby.
Christina Crosby. I'm sure there have been others, but can you
Wayne Kustenbaum, I adore.
Oh, right.
Teacher of mine. Eve Sedgwick, teacher of mine. Eileen Miles. I read that a lot.
We talked about Eileen, I think, last time you were here.
Yeah.
It's like starting, and like we did definitely talk about San Francisco, but I'm just curious because I think some people listening out there might be like, God, I would really love to have a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get a mentor? Like, no, because no one's ever come to me and been like, Brad, you know
I'll
what?
Be your mentor.
I want to mentor you.
Yeah.
But people want to mentor you.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, Eileen Miles, she always says she hates the word mentor. And, you know, I don't, it's not like a word I don't know that I would like self choose it per se. I think I've just always been, like, I think some people like to bury a little bit who they've been big fans of, or who they've, you know, who are really important to them. And I've just kind of always been the reverse, where I just always wanted to pay a lot of homage, you know? So I think that I just kind of made a decision early in my writing life that I would try and do that. But it's also
in writing and in person?
In writing. I mean, I think it's also mixed with, well, it's mixed with a few things. I think intergenerationally, especially with feminist or queer things, are really, you know, but it doesn't have to be that. But people, you know, it saddens me how quickly people lose sight of what people did before you. And I, you know, I was like that as a young feminist, I'm sure too. I'm sure gave, but I think I also was always really, you know, amazed and never had any urge to like, you know, the whole kind of Oedipal thing of, you know, of slaying your fathers or whatever. I was just more like, oh my God, look at these mothers who like did so much amazing stuff for me. So I was always really wanted to, that was always amazing. And then I also think that, what was I going to say? It was something about, oh, I don't know, it'll come back to me. But I think, I know what it was I also made a decision in my early 20s or mid 20s or something that I would try as a writer to if I was writing about artists or other people or different things, that for the most part, I've had some big swerves for certain moments, but for the most part, I would try and write people about people whose work really excited me or that I admired, and that I wouldn't get kind of bogged down in, which is why I don't write very many reviews of things. Like, I'll write a review if I have the time and I read something that I think is amazing, but I just don't really, I don't know, it's just like not my sport to... I mean, to tear, because I think I know I could do it. Like, I know I could tear things apart pretty easily, and I've done it in my enclosed quarters, you know. But it's not the part of my brain that I'm really most proud of, or that I think is what is most. It's kind of like back to the Twitter thing. It's something I feel kind of. It just feels too easy to me.
Well, and so I have mixed feelings about criticism too. Like, as something that I would do.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I don't know if I would enjoy that or if it would be, like you say, a good use of my time. I do like reading certain criticism.
Yeah.
And it usually usually involves the critic working autobiographically somehow.
Uh-huh, right, yeah.
Like, if there's not an element of that,
yeah.
I kind of recoil a little bit. I'm like, okay, put some of your own skin in the game if you're going to do this.
Yeah.
And I like when they somehow weave like a personal narrative into it. And some people are just really smart readers and can, you know, they can... Yeah. They can illuminate a work, even if they don't necessarily enjoy it.
Yeah.
They can still, like, you know, sometimes a quote unquote bad review by a good critic can make me want to go read the book.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
And that's maybe what a bad review should do.
Yeah.
or maybe never read it ever. But
yeah.
So there's you mentioned Wayne Kestenbaum, and when I was getting ready to talk to you, I read about an exchange that you guys had back in the day where I think you were his student.
That's true.
And he said something to the effect of, don't get bogged down by the heavyweights.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Which I think the interview that you were doing or the way that you were writing about it, you said it had this really freeing effect because I think at that point in your life, you're a student.
Yeah.
And you're reading all these
books
by the heavyweights.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But also wanting to carve out some space for yourself and wanting to do your own work.
Yeah.
And I just want to hear you talk a little bit about that idea, because I think this is a common experience for writers who have some ambition or who want to try to punch above their weight or whatever you want. You know what I'm saying?
And then all
of a sudden you're like, oh, my God, like, can you say it any better than this? Is there a reason for me to be here?
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think he was kind of talking about like that, and I think he was also kind of trying to, I mean, the way I took it in part because I'm a huge fan of his books too, was that like, you know, you may not be someone with, you know, 3 PhDs and, you know, the classics and philosophy or whatever, and that you're kind of like, you know, you're not going to be attending these, I'm not personally, you know, doing like continental philosophy debates at the European Graduate School or whatever, but it's like what the kind of writing he does offers something that a lot of that writing is not doing at all, you know, and that he can write about whether it's Humiliation or Jackie O or Harpo Marx and really contribute something, kind of stealing from these other spheres of, you know, heavyweight thought, but that actually making a new thing, which I don't really think of it in terms of like, oh, you know, like reach more people, like more accessible, because I don't even think of his work necessarily as accessible, but it's just making kind of art using thought, you know, and that seemed like something I could do, you know, and wanted to do. So I think that not getting bogged down with the heavyweights, I think also just meant like, you know, everything that's written and that exists for you to use and steal and lean on and borrow and think through. And it doesn't, you don't have to, you know, there's not like a passport that you need to have stamped to get into their kingdom, which I think is really important, especially for, you can go read, you know, Nietzsche, you can go read, anybody can, you know what I mean? There's some philosophers or some theory are more difficult than others, but nobody is, you know, I think people can talk up the lack of access that may, to a point where they might be actually projecting a kind of edifice around it that isn't necessarily there. I mean, a lot of people are just madmen, mad women, mad in-betweeners, whatever, writing.
With a few good ideas.
Yeah, I mean, like, and it's all out there. So I think that was, I think he was also probably talking about, which was one of the reasons why he was such a great mentor, as it were, to me, and still is, which is that, like, I, you know, was in graduate school and was going to get a PhD, and but I already could kind of tell or feel that academia wasn't going to be like an easy home for me, as it's not for many writers in a way. But I think, you know, knowing that he could find a home doing precisely what he does and wants to do, and not being bogged down with not just the heavyweights like Heidegger, but the heavyweights just like, you know, the academic world of people who have totally lost sight of thinking that like their fiefdom is everything, and I don't need to, you don't need to get, you know, turned around by all that as well, you know.
So when you talk about, you know, like Wayne's work and how, you know, he's found a home for it in the world doing this kind of specific thing that's very, it's very much him, mm-hmm. you know, he's like, like singular.
Yeah.
And I feel the same way about your work. Like you, like a Maggie Nelson book is sort of its own beast, mm-hmm. and that's cool.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, like, do you feel yourself working in a certain tradition? Do you feel yourself trying to be singular? Mm-hmm. Like, and like, it's so personal yeah. and like yeah. the intellectual, and editorial processes mm-hmm. that you go through, you know, there's like a rendering and at the end of it, it's like this, yeah. Combination of yeah. poetry and prose and yeah. essay and criticism yeah, and autobiography yeah. and, you know, all yeah. these different elements that go into your work. And it's kind of this, like, this great stew. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But is there like a, is there some line you can trace?
I mean, I think so, which is why I don't really, when people say like genre busting or something, you're like, that's fine. But like, there's much, much work that wasn't like, I think that there's a kind of, I think the narrative that writers write into these pre-existing genres, or they, you know, or they don't, you know, crazy, is a, I don't know. I think I my personal suspicion is it might be, I don't know, this is a hypothesis that I might have developed with MFA culture or something. I don't know quite where it came from. It doesn't seem to resemble the history of literature such that I see it per se. I mean, yes, you can, it seems like it's a kind of mapping of like, I mean, yes, you can study the history of the novel and there is something called the novel and all the rest of it. But I think that, you know, I've always really, you know, Emerson, Sir Thomas Browne, David Vonarovich, I mean, Hervé Guibert in France. I mean, like, there's so many people who write strange pieces of writing that are in between fantasia and nonfiction, or, you know, I mean, it's so I think there's a lot of, to me, it's not really, I mean, that said, I think you're right that the books that I've written have been really, I don't know what to say. They don't, the content just dictates whatever ends up being the book. It doesn't, I don't like decide beforehand on some genre or form or something. I just really kind of fight it out, you know, and then it is what it is. So,
and you have to have yeah. like an intuitive sense of when it's working.
Yeah. And I mean, I think of it as very, I mean, I think of it as literary, but I also think of it, I mean, I live with an artist and I watch him struggle with aluminum, or, you know, I think like, it's like the words don't seem as material because they seem evanescent because they're showing up on your Mac. But, you know, essentially you're, you know, I mean, George Oppen, a poet I deeply adore, you know, was notorious, I guess, for like hammering pieces of his poems on top of each other with nails and stuff. And like, I mean, I really do feel like it's constructing something, and that once you construct a little bit of it, even if it's just like a paragraph, like, and if it feels alive to me, then I kind of have to be like, what is this beast? Like, what do I like about this paragraph, and why, like, what form does it indicate the next, you know? So I think it does in that way, I feel like, build itself out. And, you know, and I've been, I think because I've worked that way, I've also never, you know, I never came at publishing the way that a lot of people do, which is like through book proposals or whatever. It's always been like, hey, I made this weird thing. Like, anybody interested? And mostly in my life, contrary to the past, you know, couple of years maybe of what might seem, but mostly people have been like, no. Like, mostly it's, well, like, no, we're not interested. And I go, okay. And then I just keep looking till someone will do it.
But I was going to say, like, yeah. You know, there's, I think, a certain confidence in that approach, like a belief in your yeah. work and in yourself and in the project that you're
yeah.
Doing.
Yeah.
But then I also was going to say, you know, you mentioned some of these writers and the tradition that you're working in, you know, some of the people who have been working in a similar vein, making weird books or whatever yeah. you want to call them, not all of whom or many of whom didn't find a huge readership.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Your work is finding a readership. I think the Argonauts blew things up pretty good. And I guess it brings to mind like the question of accessibility. Because I, you know, I never feel like when I'm reading you, like you're writing down, you know, like, like reading a Maggie Nelson book is challenging in a great way, but you do have to let people in, you know, you can, like you talk about like getting bogged down by the heavyweights or whatever. Sometimes the heavyweights can sort of be sadists, you know, it's like, you don't know what I know and I'm going to make it really difficult for you to find out. And, you know, you find a way to strike a balance between challenging your reader, but also bringing them in. And like, how do you... Are you
plenty of people on Goodreads or Amazon would disagree with you, which is perfectly fine by me. I mean, there's nothing funnier to me than reviews or someone saying, like, she thinks she's so smart. Because it's like, it's just so, I mean, you know, I mean, even the people you're talking about who you're, you know, not meanly, but just lightly accusing of, like, larding their work up with kind of booby traps to make it hard. I mean, I doubt that they are consciously. They're just doing what they feel like they need to do in the idiom that they need to do it in. And it's just things come out different ways for different people, you know?
Depends who your reader is too.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I don't write anything thinking about a reader. So if I leave ways in for other people, then that's great, but it's not, I don't care if I don't, you know,
you don't
I mean?
Think about a reader.
No,
like you're not writing for Harry or writing to like your editor or your agent or like thinking about like nothing like that.
No.
It's just for like your own eye.
Yeah.
It's all about me, baby.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even for me. It's just like, it's a metabolic, procedure with thoughts. Like if like you have stuff in your head and it needs to come out, so you make it come out and you don't feel good if I'm not participating in that process, but it doesn't really, I mean, the Argonauts, you know, was a total accident that, I like your phrase, what'd you say? It broke open things real good or something.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that was a real accident and it just as easily might not have happened, you know? I don't see that was like an inevitability or that it, even with that book, I don't think it was an inevitability.
You mean that the book was written or that the book received the reception?
It received the reception that it did. I mean,
okay.
I don't think it, it just seemed to me like a very happy accident, you know, but I actually don't think the book, I think it was maybe even, you know, I mean, it was timely, but I don't think it was particularly more accessible than other books I've written. So
I have a theory on this.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you.
Okay,
happened.
Great. You tell me what happened. All right.
But no, I feel like Bluettes, was one, like generated an enormous amount of goodwill.
Mm.
It might've been in a specific channel, but I know because I've got my finger on the pulse of literature.
I believe you.
I've had more people come through here and we talk about Bluettes or people mention that book.
Oh, that's
and
so sweet.
I think that book brought people in.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it's sort of, you know, it's like seeding the field. And then when the Argonauts came out, people were ready for it because you had already...
Right.
Won them
there
over.
There was a book in between. I'll mention.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know.
Yeah,
I just, I and maybe you see it differently, but like, I feel like Bluettes struck some sort of chord.
Right.
And I think too, you know, and the Argonauts does this too. You do such like great compression, but it feel like I'm forever in search of this, is trying to get like that really compact book that feels heavy. And both of those books do that.
That's good.
So anyway,
Bluettes was very, you know, Bluettes was, the reception of that book was also, has been, I mean, that book reception was very gratifying in a totally different way, which is that like it didn't, you know, it had the normal death that small, you know, it just came and the quiet. I mean, it just came and was like, but I always felt like, and this is a really, you know, conceited thing to say, but I always felt like, I mean, I think of all my books, actually, I felt like when I finished that book, I felt like I had resolved it more perfectly than I'd resolved any other thing I'd written. So I felt really proud of it. I felt like, it was like, it didn't matter to me what happened. I was like, it was like a puzzle. And I'd also been carrying it with me for many years. I really had always wanted to write a book about the color blue, and it was much smaller, much more, as you say, like much more. I mean, I say this in the book, I'd wanted it to be like this, you know, 300 page. I mean, I imagine like my book on the color blue is like, you know, a doorstop. And it was so horrifying that it came out to 99 pages. I couldn't even get to 100, but I did feel like it did what I wanted it to do. And then when it was like great and then quiet as usual, I was like, whatever, you know, on to the next thing. But then it was so happy making to see it over the years, people kind of like it kind of spreading around.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, really cheery.
Well, sometimes like these things, they take a while, you know, but they find like people pass. It's like a book that people pass or recommend, you know, and one by one.
Yeah, I like the way that book, I've had a lot of people tell me that it was either given to them like in the beginning of a new relationship or as the relationship dissolved, like a divorce book or whatever. I like the idea of a love book that can serve on both ends.
It's versatile.
Yeah, versatile.
That's the key.
Exactly, yeah. Maybe not accessible, but versatile. So
I'm not going to ask you questions about your writing process just because... maybe we covered that the first time around, and I feel like you've probably been asked that a million times. And
sorry, I don't really have one, so there's nothing to say.
But I do want to ask you about your reading. You're a writer who, to a degree that maybe is like more than most, I can feel the reading that you do in your work.
Yeah, yeah. I know a lot of people ask me what books influenced a book I just wrote, when I'm like, everything, it's all in there.
It's all in there.
It's all in there.
Everything. It's just like a cruise.
I gave it all at the office. I gave you like 400 titles and like, well, I don't have any more. You know, like that was
Like, let's talk about like the reading process that goes in. Like, I know that like book that you read, might have read when you were 21
right,
might wind up going into this book about freedom that you're working on. But you must have like, you know, a concrete list of books and things that you're reading to inform a project.
Right. Yeah.
Like where you're like, I want to learn about freedom, so I want to read X, Y, and Z. Like, how much do you do?
Yeah.
How do you fit the reading into your day?
Yeah.
How long do you read before you start to write? Are you doing both simultaneously?
Yeah. Those are all good questions. I think it's exactly as you describe, where I think that there are things that you read throughout your life that stick very strongly with you and that you're kind of shocked that you're like, wow, I'm really going to go back to, you know, that John Cage essay I read in high school. Okay. Like, what did that say? And then you go back and look it up. But I think often like the deepest seeds of books for me are that way. Like there's something that you read and, it struck the kind of ambition chord, not ambition in a bad way, but like, I want to do that or, you know, be that or, and then I think you're right. Then there's a lot of things that I read, in service of a project and, you know, I mean, I'm pretty, if I'm reading kind of, I mean, I'm embarrassed of how I read for writing projects because I feel like I become very, you know, utilitarian, and like I can tell pretty quickly if I think something's going to be like useful to me or not. And if not, I thank God I finally moved to a house on a street that has one of those lending libraries, which is just great for me because now like I order books or whatever, and if it comes in the mail, I'm like, you know, I ordered Camille Paglia's like Free Men, Free Women, Free Love or whatever it's called the other day. I like read three pages and I was like, I'm hearing about her for years. Maybe I've missed the boat. Realize I didn't. To the book box it goes, you know.
But I don't think that's bad. Right. I think that there isn't any point, or at least this is how I soothe myself for not necessarily loving the masterpieces that, you know, a college syllabus tells me I should love. Like I can't get into certain authors who everybody celebrates and some things are just not for you. And especially if you're working on a project, like time's a wasting. Like you got to, you want to get the book done.
I mean, I do look out for, again, with the kind of writing criticism, which I've been doing, you know, as of late, I look out for like, it's dangerous if I get a book that I really hate because then it makes like really low hanging fruit. And I could very easily see like, oh, a whole chapter where I demolish this particular book that just let it be. Like, if it's a bad thought, like let that book sail off into the ether. It doesn't need me to like get all into it, you know. And my partner's always telling me like, I don't think that book is worth your time, or I don't think that person's worth your time. And I kind of have to like gnash through it, you know, which is hard right now, I think, because the political sphere is really full of, you know, most things are not worth our time. And yet here we are like dragged down into them with these talents. And so I think it's really, you know, it becomes even more and more challenging. It becomes like it's not just a taste project about what, you know, what good aesthetic choices do I want to make. It also can be like a, you know, a political saga whereby you think, you know, the more I focus on disempowerment or the more I focus on, you know, all the things I think that are toxic going on right now, like the less I'm perhaps putting out something that is actually something that stands other than that, which has always been really crucial to me as a writer, is like, I mean, everyone says this, but I hope I really mean it. But like, I want the books to do not just to describe, you know, like I want them to be something as well, which is what I, even when I write criticism, I want that too. Like, so if people say, oh, I read this and I felt a sense of permission or a sense of freedom, or, you know, that's really meaningful to me, because it means that it didn't just kind of give you a good argument. It, like, it gave you an affective feeling that something was possible where you thought it was foreclosed, you know?
Well, I think like one of the aspects of your work is I was like, kind of chewing on it, getting ready for our talk. And it was like, how's she doing this?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a high level of intellectual rigor, but it's also very personal.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you said earlier, like, you don't share all of yourself, but
right.
You pick what you share. And like, you're one of those writers where I'm like, oh, she's going there, you know? But it makes you lean in. And like, obviously there's like sexual writing, but there's also like, you know, frank discussion of like suicidal ideation.
Right. Sure.
Which that like typically, whether it's sex, suicide, mm-hmm. relationship stuff, self-doubt, self-harm, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I think there can be shame in writers, mm-hmm. in people.
Yeah.
But when you're sitting there to write, I know this firsthand, you sometimes like retract a little bit. You have the willingness to go there.
Yeah.
And I think that brings people in.
Mm-hmm,
I think that makes people emote as a reader.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I think that stuff sort of leavens the intellectual.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that fair?
I mean, I think it's totally fair. It's not a formula, you know, like it's not like, what's that song my kid listens to? A little bit of sugar makes the medicine go down or whatever. Like hopefully, and from my end, it's more natural than that, you know? And not everything I write, you know, some books, I mean, the books that tend to seize more people have been the more ones with more autobiography in them. And if I could keep doing that, I would. But like for the moment, for example, like I feel like, you know, after the Argonauts, I'm kind of like, okay, like that shop is a little closed for a little while.
Yeah.
But, you know, but also just as like a... you want to keep trying new things as a writer. So if everyone says like, oh, she really delivers all this feminist and queer theory, but from a personal standpoint, you kind of feel like, well, what else can I do? You know, what else can I do? It roves, but I think what you're describing, you know, I mean, I have a lot of shame, as does everybody. I don't think anyone is ever like a shameless human being. And if they were, you know, they would not be probably a quote unquote good human being. But I do think that, you know, when you asked about like a tradition of writing, you know, most of my heroes that I've read are completely, I mean, suicidal ideation or sexually explicit writing would just be like, you know, utterly par for the course or something.
Right.
So I think also my diet of what I've read and the people that I've known, you know, I have a different kind of norm. And then when I hit, like, for lack of a better word, more mainstream places, people will be like, wow, this is really something or other. And I kind of have to recalibrate and be like, oh, yes, you know.
But the effect
for you, the word placenta is going to be disruptive. For like where I come from, my friends are like, you know, making placenta chips and like sitting around talking about their suicidal ideations. Like it's a negotiation of worlds, you know.
There's nothing.
Don't quote me.
When I'm suicidally ideating.
Right, yeah, you love placenta.
I love to be eating placenta chips, just to sort of balance it out. But I feel like the other thing I was thinking, I was like, as a reader, it makes me, when people are writing from a really honest place, talking about the stuff of life that includes a lot of the stuff that we don't talk about very much, it makes me take the writing more seriously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
that's
mm-hmm.
the effect. And for some reason that like, I found that like to be an epiphany. I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Like when you go
you take the writing as writing more seriously, or just take like the person behind it or the whole enterprise?
The whole enterprise. I was like, oh, okay. So someone's getting real with me. Like that's the effect that it has on me.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's also inspiring because it's like, okay. Like,
yeah,
I'm sure that's why you love the books that you are talking about. You know, that
absolutely.
You're,
yeah.
You know, it's like, I love when I can feel like somebody's no bullshit.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because there's so much of that in the world.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, it obviously presents challenges, especially if you're working autobiographically, relationally.
Sure.
I'm going to read a quote to you that made me laugh.
Okay.
Your partner, Harry, said, being with Maggie is like an epileptic being married to a strobe light artist.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, how do you, like when you write a book, like The Argonauts, for example, obviously you probably shared that pre-publication with the people who are most implicated and say, what do you think? Like, how do you go through those processes?
Just like that, you know?
What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think that different books have their own, you know, I mean, you have these different tiers. You have, like, people who I don't talk to, but you don't want to get sued by, people that you live with intimately, and you don't want them to even be, like, a little bit mad at you, because that will influence, like, your daily life, you know? So there's kind of, like, a very big spectrum, but I generally... I mean, I've Harry, my partner, just wrote an amazing book that is going to be published.
What's it called?
It's called My Meteorite.
Okay.
My Meteorite, comma.
Are you in it?
I am.
Okay,
yes.
So it's like the revenge of Harry.
Yes, although, if, you know, but I'm, he let me read it, and I took out the parts I didn't like, and, you know, I've been on lightly on both sides of this, you know, before, and I know when things, you know, I've had cause to know how bad it does feel to be written about. And I think that, you know, and I feel like I don't have any regrets. I mean, occasionally I forget my books. Like, I don't really spend, you said you don't listen to your podcast. I don't read my books, you know, and like they come out and I'm like, I don't like take it down and you know, flip through it for fun.
Right.
So occasionally I'll take out a book and I'll be like, oh, like, wow, really? I said that, you know, so I mean, I don't have any regrets per se, but you know, I think, I mean, I'm lucky in that I don't have too many wasted relationships vis-a-vis my writing. And some of them, like with Christina Crosby and with Harry now, I think the thing that pisses people off the most is often the feeling that, like, you took control of a story that was also theirs, you know, and that they didn't get to, like, have their say. And I think it's really satisfying when people are like, I'm going to write my own fucking book.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Now
and
it's
I'm
my
like,
turn.
Great, do it, you know? And I think that, but I think that, you know, my mom, I've written about a lot, and she's kind of found a certain peace with it and stuff. So, you know, I haven't had too many. I mean, I've had a few. I'm not going to lie.
You have courage, though.
I have a few, relations that have, you know, shredded. But you know, they weren't relations that were, you know.
Sometimes you get, wait, what's the old phrase? You can't, like Norman Mailer, I know he's, you know, people have deep feelings about Norman, but he has a great line where he's like, a writer who's afraid to offend people is like a surgeon who's afraid to cut.
Right.
Yeah, like if you're gonna do the work,
right,
you have to be sort of fearless about it. It's easier said than done, but I think that's true.
I mean, I think it's like, again, kind of degrees, like there's fearless and there's reckless. I've been both. But I don't think, and, you know, and saying things like, oh, but I'm not mean, or oh, but I'm not whatever, like, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. Like, you know, you could describe someone's hair in a way that hurts their feelings, even when you're just naming its color. You know, like, it doesn't really, you don't have to assassinate somebody in print for them to feel awkward. And I think, you know, I think it's essentially, I mean, I'm reading Karl Ove Knausgård's book 6 of My Struggle right now, and the whole book so far, the first 100 or 200 pages, is very focused on the publication of book 1 and his uncle's lawsuits and threats and how sick it makes him feel inside, and like, is he really going to go through with this and stuff? And I think...
I was telling you before, I think we came on, how handsome I find him.
Yes.
His hair. I want to look like him.
You're not alone.
Yeah. He's just he's like when you say like Scandinavian writer, I'm like, that's the guy. He smokes, but he still looks good. It's good, you know.
But I think it's like, you know, there's not, again, it's not like there are all these degrees, you know, like, and I think at the end of the day, you know, I mean, I don't know if you're working on this in your Brad Dad book, but, you know, I think, you know, the most challenging thing for me this past year was probably people asking me over and over and over and over again in interviews about writing about your children, which, you know, has like a huge other charge to it, and other things have. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about it just because it's like a, you know, it's a very gendered situation. Like Norman Mailer's quote that you just said, you know, no one likes to imagine mothers as surgeons cutting anything, or, you know what I mean? Like, it's not a, and so I think it's, but you know, my dear friend, Eula Biss, who's very wise and smart and has written a lot of great books, that your listeners probably know, but you know, Eula, we did a panel And you know, again, like on Immunity, I don't know if you've read it, but it's like, you know, she's talking about like buying her son like a hypoallergenic mattress. She's not like giving a, you know, knockdown, drag out account of his entire life or personality, you know. People are still asking her how she feels. She could have written about, you know, the son's mattress, and she just said, you know, my son has two nonfiction writers for parents, and that will be his burden to bear. And, you know, I hope to give him some things, and this is one of the things. And, you know, and I feel like at a certain point, as with everything, you have to reckon with who you are. And
Like, otherwise you're never going to say anything.
No.
I mean, and how can you write about the stuff of your life if that's the mode that you're working in?
Yeah.
And if you're a parent, how can you not write about your kids?
No. And also it's very, like you were saying about reading people, writing things that are real, like reading other people's experiences deeply, how we feel embedded with each other in our shared struggles or alien struggles, you know? So it would be really preposterous to not offer that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you a question about getting through a project. This is maybe like somewhat selfish because I'm like grinding through this book and trying to find the form and trying to figure out like how to be, like, I have an impulse to be funny, which might come from, like, this kind of insecure need to be liked.
Uh-huh.
But I also, I like to laugh when I'm reading.
Sure.
Or
yeah,
at least, like, you know, a little, like, smile or something. But I like a little humor. But yet, I'm dealing with dark stuff and heavy stuff.
Yeah,
and, like, trying to figure out how to, like, walk that tightrope.
Yeah.
But also put the thing into a form that works.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to read something else that you said. I'm going to read another quote. And this is about Jane a Murder, which is about your aunt's murder, which I believe we talked about in our first conversation.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I think so. But your aunt, in the just so listeners who don't have context, can you maybe describe that book quickly?
Yeah, my Aunt Jane was my mother's younger sister, and she was murdered in 1969 when she was a first-year law student at University of Michigan. And she took a ride from a ride board to go home for a spring break, and whoever responded to the ad and gave her the ride, shot and strangled her and left her in a rural cemetery. And it was thought to be one of seven murders in the area. So I wrote a book about its unsolved nature. And then after that book came to be published, there was a DNA match with her case that was of a suspect different from the person who was in prison for one of the other serial murders. And that person was convicted in 2005, I believe, of her murder. So it was a very long story about which I wrote two books. But the first one, Jane, they're very different. One's like the latter one, the red parts, is a kind of courtroom prose experiment. And the earlier one was a much, much longer process of, you know, 8 years of writing and collecting. And it was, I guess you call a narrative in poems or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a unique book.
Yeah.
In that it's like a poem narrative, but it works, you know? And so here's something you said about it. You said that book took me took 8 years for me to make peace with the fact that I was writing it. That book is a book that taught me about the bad idea. Every day I would kind of come home from a movie or the library and I was like, I shouldn't do it. I don't like it. It's scaring me. You have no idea how much I relate to this. And so I guess like it's like, I want to hear you talk about getting past that feeling. Because I think a lot of writers go through that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this, I always call it like it's like a wrestling match or something. Trying to like come to grips with it, trying to see it clearly, trying to get okay with saying it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, how did you get there? How do you get there?
It's funny. I think I might have changed my mind about this over the years. I think that I maybe used to feel like my bad ideas were really bad ideas because they were so kind of transgressive to my family or something violent or something kind of traumatic. Now I've come to believe after writing many different books that almost anything you focus on can feel like a bad idea because you can just see like all of its flaws. And, you know, like I'm writing a book right now about freedom and it's like, how dumb is that? You know, freedom. Like, it's like, and everybody you talk to,
I'm already excited about it.
Oh, great. Well, but like, if you talk to, you know, I mean, Wittgenstein, whom I adore, you know, had this great quote, I'm going to get it wrong, but he said something like, you know, my philosophy is very useful for people who share my problems. If you don't have my same problems, this book might not be very interesting to you. But like, you know, when one describes one's obsessions or some thing you're perseverating on, you know, most people are not going to share your exact problem. And they're going to be like, they'll offer some glib thing like, oh, why don't you just drop it? Or, oh, it doesn't sound like it's so complicated to me. Whatever, because they're not you, right? So like, part of me realizes now that you just have to, you have to recognize that the feeling that just by the act of your focusing on it, like everything is going to seem not good enough. You're going to see the book that you might write that's the bad version. I mean, that to me, that's like a very strong thing. It's like there's often, and often they exist in the world. They'll be like, but they're very instructive. They're the shadow bad book. They're like, they're your bad dad book that like you're so mad at. You see at the airport, you're like, I can't believe that, you know. Yeah. I can't think of a bad example of like an airport bad dad book, but like Brad Dad, this book's not bad dad, it's Freudian. But like, so anyways, like, I mean, you have this feeling like, I don't want it to be this, you know. And I think that can be very, you know, so like you're kind of like bowling where you're trying to kind of like keep it, you know, like you're going for the strike. You don't want like the alleys are kind of like the books that you see on the side that can be, you know, what you really hope it doesn't turn out to be. I mean, if you're really worried about that, it probably really will not be one of those books. I mean, people rarely write the book that they're most frightened of writing. But I do think that you're right that like, you know, I mean, I joke in The Argonauts that, like, it's hard to know if a bad idea is a bad idea because it's a bad idea, or if it's a bad idea because it feels so, you know, it just feels dangerous in some way. It feels.
But
like,
that can be a good sign.
Yes, but that's the thing, is it can be a good sign. It doesn't guarantee that the book will be good, but I don't think, but I think what it indicates is that there's a feeling of risk, and I don't personally feel like that much writing, you know, people use words and, you know, MFA culture like risk or stakes or whatever, and like, but you know, but those are real concepts, you know. And if you don't feel as though there were stakes to the writing, I don't think that the reader is going to feel them either, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, and I think like, I don't know, if you don't seem to have like the same like neurotic need to try to like throw jokes in that I do. It's like, I mean, sometimes it's appropriate. Other times it's like the subject matter serious, like just be serious.
Yeah. Well, I'm not very funny, so I don't have any like a, it's not.
Many people would say that I'm not either.
It's not a, like any humor I ever have come by in my life is like a, you know, if anyone tells me something's funny or like if anybody laughs at a reading, I'm always really gratified. I mean, I laugh a lot, but like, you know, I mean, I think that there's like a certain grim humor in some of my books, but they're not really funny.
But there's, I think there's a strength in that, you know, I mean, I guess like there's also,
you can edit your bad jokes out later. You can put them in, and cause it might be that they're really doing a lot of crutch work for you in getting out the other stuff you need to say.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't really, I mean, that's another thing I try and teach myself, which is hard. Any writer knows this is hard, but like, you know, there may be something that I'm doing while I'm writing that a certain sentence construction or a certain word that I keep leaning on. And as I'm doing it, I'm like, this is terrible. This is terrible. This is a terrible sentence structure. This is a terrible word. But like, if, you know, but if you get stuck there, then you like, then I'll start thinking, okay, well, you know, sentences can be rearranged, you know, whole, you know, I can go, we can go back to this, but you know, it's that thing about trying to keep
momentum,
keep them going forward. Yeah.
So. Yeah. And it doesn't sound like, I mean, I think I was reading something about your drafting process. I told you I wasn't going to ask you about your writing process, but I think listeners are always interested to know how people do it.
Yeah.
You don't do like the big vomit draft. You're one of those people who writes and kind of edits as you go.
I do. Yeah. Because I, even though I'm saying that I can live with a bad sentence structure, I feel much better when I arrive back at the desk the next day. And I usually print out what I did the day before and like take it all away.
Okay. Because that's what
I
want.
And then I start again with a document that doesn't have quite as many bad sentences staring at me.
But you look at a hard copy.
I do.
Because I think one of the problems that I run into, because I'm the same way, I edit as I go, but I'm editing in Word.
Yeah.
And so what happens is I noodle with things to death, and it becomes overwrought.
Yeah.
So it's better to print, right?
It's all I know how to do. And I mean, I think I have a long time practice of, I mean, God forbid, you're probably about as old as I am, but you know, we didn't have ye old laptops when I was,
I had like a little
up.
Brother, a, like word processor.
Yeah, I had a big desktop, whatever. But I also lived in New York. So like, I mean, also for my body, which is another big thing about writing, which is, you know, drives me crazy, which is like, it hurts to sit in the chair all day. And
I stand up. I've started standing.
Yeah. I mean, my body's like a mess. So it's like, hard copy to me always meant like change of venue. You could go to the park. I could lie down on my stomach and do it. Like I can't sit. I can't stay at that computer. It just makes me crazy.
I think there's something to be said for that.
Yeah.
Like I was talking to a writer and I'm forgetting who it was, but they were saying that in the editing process, same as you, it's like a hard copy.
Yeah.
It's a change of venue,
yeah.
But it's like a specific change of venue to like try to read.
Yeah.
in a place and in a posture that an ordinary reader would read it
exactly.
in.
And also you probably pretend like it's not mine. So I just feel like I just get it. And I'm like, oh, I mean, I literally like have a little game where I pull it out of the bag and I go, yeah, I just go, oh, what's this? You know, but my pen is very, I mean, if I ever lose something, say like I edit a hard copy and then like, God forbid, like my computer crashes and I lost what I did. I mean, what I've noticed over the years, which is a little alarming, but like, you know, my edits will be exactly the same. Like if I go do it over again, like,
really?
Like it just is meant to sound a certain way. And so it's like, it just, and I'm always shocked that like I would re-edit it the same way again.
That's
so
gotta be comforting.
It is. Cause I feel like it makes me feel like there's a platonic thing that it's going for.
And also that like you have a true eye.
Yes,
you know what
exactly.
I'm saying?
Like, and I edit, I mean, I write all over my student papers. I'm sure that they just want to kill me, but like, I just have always edited a lot by hand and I just, it's like my way of.
And then you go back like, and re-enter it in the computer.
Exactly, yeah.
Like the same day
mm-hmm.
or the next day.
Yeah, whenever, yeah.
Okay. And then what about Genesis? Yeah. Like you talk about this, I don't know. I know a little bit about your writing past and I know that like Bluettes, for example, was something that had sort of been incubating for years and years and years, going back to childhood.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, The Argonauts, Freedom, all these other books, The Freedom Project, for example. Like, how do you know when you've got a book? Like, okay, now this is what I'm going to be working on. Like, is there a through line that you can trace? Is there a similarity from project to project?
No, I think it's just like, no, they're all different. But I think that, I think maybe like a lot of writers, I always live in fear that when I actually express my thoughts, that it'll be very small. You know, like I said before, like the blue book was very smaller, but. I've been doing this for a while, so like I have a better sense now. Like if I'm taking notes, for example, or if I'm like stacking up books with, you know, post-its in them of passages that I care about, I can tell at a certain number of notes or a certain level of things that if I were to say everything I had to say about what I'd amassed, I'd be like, well, this probably looks like about 50,000 words I probably have on my mind around now. You know what I mean? And so I think it's like, I think that. But then other books like The Argonauts wasn't really a book. Like it was not really a book for a long time. It was kind of, I wasn't like setting out to write that book. It wasn't an explicit desire.
That seems like a winning formula.
What? To the
just not me, like in kind of accidentally
writing
a
like,
book that wins the National Book Critics Award.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, it hasn't won before. I mean, it wasn't a winning formula for a long time. But I think that it's, you know this too. Like our minds are much more predictable and organic than we presume them to be. So like we have the same preoccupations. We get attracted to different webs of things and like, And like, for example, in the Freedom book, there's a chapter about drugs. And, you know, I've been thinking about drugs forever and reading. I love teaching a class. I've taught often on drug literature. And
I'm fascinated by drugs, too.
Yeah, and I'm really interested in.
I just read the Michael Pollan hallucinogen book. And very fascinated by psychedelics in particular.
Yeah, interesting.
All of it is of interest to me.
Yeah, and I've always, you know. Like a lot of my favorite books are drug related, Taipei. I mean, so not that that's one of my favorite books, but I've taught it in my drug literature class and stuff. But I guess the point is that like, I began to realize that part of my interest in drugs was because drugs represent a certain, it became interesting to me about why people always think of these books, whether it's On the Road or whatever, you know, these drug books as like, icons of freedom, when in fact, you know, the experience of drugs is often really one of enslavement. I mean, addiction is so this kind of, you know, William Burroughs was always trying to tell people, you know, it's just need. It's not like, but it doesn't matter. Everyone's buying junkie and stealing it off the shelves, you know, so I realized that was kind of a paradox about freedom is that like, you know, we feel transgression and liberation about these substances that also have a very strong element of, I mean, like all the good heroin books, for example, will usually talk about heroin as a relieving of the burden of how to structure a life. Like, you know what you're doing. You're getting hot. You're getting dope. Like, that's it. It structures your whole day. And then, you know, and then it's very, you know, you're counting hours. I mean, it's like, you know, it provides a lot of grid, whereas we think of it as like, woohoo, you know, right. But it's not really, you know? So all I'm trying to say is that, like, I might recognize that that whole area of interest of mine is a subset of a greater interest of mine in this freedom thing. So it's like, I've just noticed that a lot in my time that, like, your brain is more, like, my interest to me might seem very far and wide. Like, geez, like the Argonauts was like, oh, I have all this writing about, you know, homonormativity, you know, and then I have all this writing about, like, the first year of taking care of an infant. Too bad those are different projects, and then you eventually realize that they
go together.
That they're part of the same project, you know.
You know, it's the thing that you were just saying about drugs and freedom strikes a chord with me, because I think that, like, the flip side of that is that while drugs often have this, like, strong element of enslavement, discipline often contains within it, like, a lot of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've been trying to get up super, super early for, you know.
You're not doing that, like, sleep thing where, like, you go to bed twice.
No, but I don't sleep as much. Like, this is the thing. Like, I don't drink wine in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I used to have, like, a couple glasses of wine.
Yeah.
And then for a while I felt guilty and Buddhist about it.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I'm defiling, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't that bad. But I was just like, why do I do this? Why do I watch, like, the news and drink wine every night by myself? Like, I'm not even with anybody.
Right.
Like, my wife's putting our daughter down, and I'm like, you know. So I got wobbly about it, but then, like, I stopped doing it. It was no problem.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an addictive, thank goodness. But I then was like, well, I want to try to get up super early so I can have time to myself without feeling like I'm ditching out on the kids. You know, you know how that feeling as a parent where you're like, I need some me time, but, like, your kid needs you and your wife or your spouse or whatever, you know. And so I found that it's actually like, way less stressful for me. My life feels less stressful when I have that discipline. I feel freer.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's kind of a weird, like, epiphany that I had. Maybe I should have had it a long time ago, but I'm like, oh, wow. Like, I might, like, have to live a little bit more austere, austerely, but it's actually freeing me up.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think it's what most wise people eventually recognize. And, you know,
it took me 43 years.
Yeah, that's all right. You know, I think it's, all those surrealist games are the same lesson, you know, is like, in terms of having to also, like, you know, trick yourself into, you know, whether it's psychoanalysis or hypnosis or surrealist games, it's like, you know, the unconscious is not that we're all going for the unconscious or that you're going for that early in the morning, but, you know, we don't just slip into these states. I mean, it's heartening to me to remember that, this is again back to how we started with, like, the Twitter thing, like, why would we imagine that, like, the first level of our consciousness or, like, your wine news thing, like, why would we imagine that was going to produce the most interesting thoughts or something, like, you know, you've got to try harder.
Yeah. This isn't working for me. This MSNBC and, you know, Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
Ritual.
It sounds pretty good right now. Cause I do the MSNBC without Pinot Noir.
I don't know how. Yeah, exactly. How do you possibly watch that stuff without, like, something? But, I say that in the interest of transparency, like, I have lately, just very recently, just to kind of I'm trying to shake myself out of being too self-conscious creatively, and I want to free myself.
Yeah.
Speaking of freedom.
Yeah.
I have been, like, microdosing cannabis and combining it with strong coffee.
Interesting. How's it going?
I find it helpful.
What's a microdose of cannabis?
Like, less than 2 milligrams of an edible.
Yeah.
But, like, it's a little wonky because, like, those things are not precise.
Right. Yeah,
and I live in fear because, like, the thing about me is, like, I don't want to get high.
Right. Yeah,
but yet I want to eat cannabis. I'm a nightmare for these people at the dispensary.
That's it, right. Yeah. Yeah.
I want, like, a little tiny something and then some caffeine. And I got that from Jonathan Ames.
Interesting.
I was talking to him on the show, and he's like, sometimes, you know, I just, like, get over the worries or the self-consciousness or whatever it is.
Yeah.
He's like, I just get really caffeinated and a little baked.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, maybe I should. And then microdosing with psychedelics has become this whole thing that I'm fascinated by, but have not done yet.
Yeah.
There's, like, the Isle That Waldman book, and Michael Pollan talks about it.
Where do they get their psychedelics?
That's the thing. Like, I'm too lazy to go source this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm also, like, I don't want to get, like, in trouble.
Yeah.
But, if somebody like were to come over, like if you were like, oh, I've got like, I would take one right now just to try it.
Yeah.
I don't want to hallucinate.
Right.
But like, I feel like the evidence is compelling enough to give it a shot.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe it could knock away some of these like, you know, cobwebs and worries in my brain or something.
That sounds great. I look forward to the report.
Now, I guess that this is a way to bring it back to you. It's like, you don't do anything like that. Like you write clear as a bell.
We're going to talk about my drug use on your podcast. There's a whole other.
Well, I'm curious though, because you're interested in drugs, but like most people, I mean, myself included, like 99% of the time in my writing life, I've been totally sober.
Right.
I don't think it's writing fucked up doesn't work.
Right. No, I mean, I quit drinking in, I don't know, 2006, I guess.
Oh,
so
okay.
I have, so I'm, you know, so I'm a sober person, but I'm very interested in, I mean, I'm also interested in writing, like, there's a great book that I use in that drug chapter quite a bit by Marcus Boone. And he makes the point, which is very interesting, and you probably would cotton to if you're interested in the psychedelics, but that, you know, each genre of drug really has created its own literary canon, and that you really can't compare narcotic literature with psychedelic literature, with, you know, alcohol literature. I mean, they are very different. And if you get kind of keyed into that, you really do, you know, talking about drug literature does become really kind of silly. And I think, so that chapter probably focuses most on narcotic literature, which I think, to my mind, is produced some of the more interesting work, you know, some kinds of literature. I mean, you know, obviously amphetamines produced a lot of work as well, but in terms of like,
So narcotic, you mean like heroin, pills, cocaine?
No, that would be a stimulant.
Oh, stimulant.
Yeah.
So narcotic. Okay. I don't know my categories as well as I should.
Opiates. I mean, I think that it's very, I mean, he even has a chapter on anesthetics, because anesthetics in the 19th century were like, you know, a thing, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's, I don't know, so I'm interested in all of it, and I'm interested in how people write and how they you know,
navigate.
Yeah.
What about what about this book? How far are you? Like are you getting close to being manuscript?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Hmm. But you know, it's really it's
how long is it? It's 34 pages.
It's about, I don't know, I've written about 320 pages.
Okay.
So it was kind of long.
That's long.
Me. Yeah. But I think a lot of it's really bad. So I'm going to go back and I got to go back. I haven't looked back. I've like finished, I've been finishing chapters and just sealing them off on the computer and not looking back. So I've got to, I have to, I haven't yet looked back. And a lot has changed since I started the book. I mean, basically, you know, a day doesn't go by when autocracy is not like the main issue on the news, you know, whereas that was, you know, Trump wasn't even running when I began the project, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't think that the book is outdated in that way. I think in some ways it actually has to struggle with being less timely, because some of the currents that I'm talking about are not this kind of classic current of I'm talking about a lot of kinds of freedom, which are not necessarily what we would think of as political freedom. So I think in that way, the conversation right now is very, very heavy in what political freedom looks like and what tyranny looks like and the rise of autocracy, all of which I'm very interested in. But that's kind of more of a shadow subject to some of the issues in the book, you know?
Well, I think it's like an exciting thought to have such a good writer and such a good thinker taking apart a concept or a word that we all think we know the meaning of.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I love that.
Right.
Cause it's like success.
Uh-huh.
That's another way.
Right. Yeah.
What the
yeah.
hell does that mean?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
like that's
yeah.
worthy of a book yeah. and, or many books. And so yeah. I'm very eager, to see what you come up with.
Thank you very much.
And I'm very excited to have a chance to sit down with you again. I know my listeners are going to be excited to hear from you. So I appreciate you making the time.
Thank you. My pleasure, Brad. Thank you.
Okay, Maggie Nelson right there. What do you think? Her poetry collection is called Something Bright Than Holes. It's available from Soft Skull Press. Just read all of her books. Make yourself a smarter, better person. Maggie Nelson, Something Bright Than Holes. She doesn't have a website, I don't think. She's not on social. You're just going to have to read her books. That's where it is. That's where things are. But really great to see her again and get a chance to pick her brain. She's one of our best. So if you would like to write to me, if you have something to say about this show, The address is letters@otherppl.com. Don't forget that this show has an app. It's free. It's the Other People app. Get it wherever you get your apps. If you want to support the program, patreon.com/otherpplpod. Thank you to Kill Rockstars, as always, and the band Stereo Total for the theme song music. Thanks to Cigarette Royalty for the interstitial music. I'm recording this in the morning. I've got a day job again. Got to, like, try to cram this in somehow. Do I sound like it's the morning? I feel like my voice sounds different at this hour. I feel like I have more gravitas or something. It's just fatigue. Do not be mistaken. It's just being up since before dawn. Having, like, weird conversations with my wife at, like, 4:30 in the morning by the light of our phones. That's how we roll. It's really healthy. It's good for you. I drank a pot of yerba mate. I also had a matcha latte. I've ingested incredible quantities of caffeinated liquid in an effort to jumpstart my day. I also went for a hike. I get a lot done before 7:30 a.m. It's just how it is, you know, right now at this stage of life. I don't know why I'm telling you all this. I'll be back again soon, next week, with another writer. I might be back even sooner. I'm thinking I might drop a Sunday episode if I can swing it. But don't hold me to that. I have a lot of good episodes in the pipeline. I've had some great conversations recently. I know I say that a lot, but it's true. I'm about to share some premium content with you.